ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Tammy Shipley believed someone was out to hurt her.
I thought someone was after me and I wanted to just be safe.
She's put under 24-hour surveillance.
I tried to get in contact multiple times.
I'm going to make a phone call. Nobody knows where I am.
And then something strange happens.
She just drank and drank and had something like 20 litres of pure water.
Ambulance emergency.
I've got a woman unconscious.
Tammy's story. Search Background Briefing on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
National property price rises have stalled. That's according to the most recent data, as three successive rate hikes and planned property tax changes seem to have dramatically shifted the market. So where to from here? And as the Australian Bureau of Statistics prepares to release GDP data later this week, there's a larger conversation going on about what it measures and what it doesn't. Welcome to ABC Business Daily. I'm Carrington Clark.
And I'm ABC News Business Editor Michael Yarder.
Michael, lovely to be sitting across with you. I've taken the keys back to the pod. Is there anything I should know about how it was driven in my absence?
Look, we hooned around a bit, Carrington, but I think Dan and I managed to avoid the bingles and bashes, maybe the odd scratch or two.
Very qualified drivers, I'm sure. It's in pretty good nick. It looks good. I haven't really looked under the hood, though. Let's start by talking about Australia's greatest passion, the property market.
What else do Australians talk about?
Well, it's kind of this and fuel at the moment. And given that with the excise cut, fuel is not that big an issue for most people when they're filling up the car. It isn't much worse or about what it was before the war in the Middle East. Property is the national obsession. This data from Cotality, this is for the month of May. And the headline figure, of course, is that property prices nationally haven't gone anywhere. Property momentum has shifted, and we're not seeing the huge rate of growth that we were at the end of last year.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, I think the fair thing to say is that the property market momentum had shifted well before even the leaks about capital gains tax and negative gearing started coming out in the lead up to the budget. Basically, as soon as the Reserve Bank started talking about raising rates towards the end of last year and then actually did it in February, that was a hammer blow to the momentum, which until then, and you know, second half of last year had been red hot in the property market. I mean, the price gains were, you know, again, almost out of this world and running well ahead of inflation and wages and all these things. So in a sense, and Tim Lawless from Cotality, their senior analyst, says this in their release about the data, you know, there was a sense that momentum had to run out because the gains were so strong. But you factor in rate rises and now these tax changes that affect property, and it's no surprise that the market's really run out of puff.
Let's break down some of the numbers, because obviously that headline figure is that there was no property price growth for the month of May. However, if you look over the past year, still up 8.8%. So with a zero for one of those 12 months, you've still got 8.8%, which is an extraordinarily high rate of increase for an unproductive asset. You know, this is, property is supposed to be a pretty safe investment, but these kind of rises are quite extraordinary for something that is relatively risk, well, has been relatively risk-free.
Yeah, and also, again, well ahead of incomes, well ahead of consumer price inflation, well ahead of rental increases, meaning that yet again, rental yields for Australian property have fallen even further and are incredibly low for any other asset class you'd look at getting a 3% or less gross yield, and professional investors would be running a mile, especially with the risk of, you know, potential price falls if there's the market correction. So, yeah, as I said, it seems like a story of we had this big momentum. It's almost fallen under its own weight, as it does from time to time. The Australian property market is not immune from falls, and particularly when you look at it in real terms rather than factoring in inflation. So if you take inflation out.
And on that point, Macquarie came out with a very interesting note last week. I want to get that into a moment. I just want to kind of drill down to some of the other numbers, because we talk about kind of an aggregate average, what's happened nationally, but there are very different stories happening around the country, aren't they? Looking at kind of the two extremes, Melbourne and Perth. Now, Melbourne has, in the time that I was overseas, went from being the second priciest place to buy a house out of the capital cities behind Sydney to, I think, what, fifth or sixth now in the country. It has just not had anywhere near the growth rate of the other capital cities. And that story is continuing. So Melbourne actually fell for the month of May, down 0.8%. And over the year was up barely 0.5%.
And actually, if you go back all the way to May 2021, Cotality says Melbourne's prices are only 3.3% higher. And then you go to the other extreme of the market, Perth's prices over that period have almost doubled. They're up 91% and a bit. And Perth, again, over the past year, nearly 26% higher. And even with the slowdown in the Perth market, still up 1.5% in a month. I mean, the Perth market is just racing along. And it's very interesting because when I did the Housing Hostages podcast last year with the News Daily team, you know, Melbourne was a bit of a case study in housing affordability precisely because prices have really gone nowhere for the last 5 years or so. And it's actually made it accessible to first home buyers. It's had one of the highest rates of first home buyer entry into the market of any of the capital cities. And it's not surprising. I imagine Perth is rapidly heading the other way as its prices go through the roof.
I have been away, but I was twigged to this piece of research from Macquarie by my fellow podcast host, Alan Kohler's analysis that is on the ABC website today. This is a piece of analysis they've called A Brief History of Australian House Prices, where they've tried to do their own forecasting of what's likely to happen in the property market. Really interesting piece of research. One of the things I found really very interesting was that, first of all, they say in real terms, dwelling prices in Australia have increased about 160% since 1980. But it says for two-thirds of that period, actually prices trended sideways. Now, real meaning that once you've subtracted inflation from those price rises, you get what the real increase in the improvement in that investment was. And it was only really these two short bursts between 2000 and 2003 and then a second burst of between 2012 and 2022 where we saw the vast majority of those gains happen. Now, they also point out that even though everyone thinks investing in property in Australia has been a complete one-way bet for multiple decades, that is not the case. They point out that if in Melbourne, in real terms, it took 11 years from the 1989 height for them to people to actually see their prices hit that height again 11 years later. And then in Perth, real prices did not get back to the 2006 level until 2024. So that was 17 years.
That was the mining boom, you know, Mark One, if you like, boom that WA had. But, you know, what's really interesting in that Macquarie note as well is that jump between 2000 and 2003, 45% in just 3 years. And they say, well, look, as economists say, correlation is not causation. But to quote the Macquarie note, the large jump in real house prices in that period suggests the introduction of the capital gains tax discount was a significant factor pushing prices higher. Yes, interest rates had been on a bit of a structural decline, but that was already happening prior to 2000 because we'd been coming off very high interest rates, moved into inflation targeting, and the real juice to the market was that September 1999 change to the capital gains tax that introduced this 50% discount, which interacted with negative gearing and suddenly made property investment a great tax minimization tool, which up to then it hadn't been as much. And essentially what the government's trying to do is unpick that. Now, if that change contributed at least in some significant part to a 45% real increase in home prices in 3 years, then one can only imagine that removing it might contribute something towards a decrease in real home prices over the years going forward.
Yeah, and so Macquarie's analysis seems to, they think that there could be either little to no real price growth for the coming decade, potentially couple of decades, and also that we could be on the cusp of another significant fall. And again, they point out that real prices have fallen by more than 9% six times since 1980. Again, this is not a one-way bet. It might sometimes feel that way when you look at headline figures and you see how much the average price of a home has increased. But actually, people have lost money in the property market depending on when they buy in. And yes, this raises the question about whether or not we're going to be on the cusp of another fall.
And a question people need to ask themselves, is that a bad thing? Because we have been moaning in this country about housing affordability for the better part of this century, basically since that 45% real jump in prices at the start of this century through housing affordability way out of whack, where we went from housing being, you know, three, maybe four times incomes to being eight in Sydney, 12 or 13 times incomes. Now, the only way to make housing more affordable is for prices to either fall in absolute terms or at least rise more slowly than people's wages and household incomes are going up. And that's a simple reality.
Yeah, and you can see that the government and the opposition, for that matter, are trying to walk a very difficult line when it comes to talking about whether or not they want house prices, dwelling prices to fall or not. Because on one hand, housing is a vital human need, right? And usually you don't want things that are needs to be increasing at a high clip. We don't want the price of water dramatically increasing. You don't want the price
groceries,
of food dramatically increasing.
Exactly.
We mostly all agree that we don't want that. But because housing is also a major generator of wealth for people, it's also a major store of people's wealth, that what you don't want is significant falls in the price of that asset because it hurts. It makes people feel less wealthy. They get stressed, they spend less, and that can have a flow-on effect to the economy
as
well.
And it's also the major asset by far on the balance sheets of all of our banks, particularly the big four banks and Macquarie as well. I mean, Macquarie's a bit more diversified, but all of these banks have literally trillions of dollars of housing assets underpinning the hundreds of billions of dollars of loans on their balance sheets. And if those housing assets fall by a significant amount, and it would take a really significant fall. The bank regulator does regular stress tests on this, and we're talking like pretty much an Irish-style housing crash to get the Australian banks into serious trouble, risk of collapse and that sort of thing. But if even a more moderate fall does raise the risk that banks will become more cautious about lending because they're taking those losses on their balance sheet, they're having to write down assets, they will have increasing loan losses. So it is a potentially big economic issue. And an interesting note last week from Westpac's economists pointing out that the two biggest impacts they see from these housing tax changes are potentially a 34% fall in investor housing credit, which would be big news for the major banks. And we've seen their share prices sell off significantly, and also a 20% fall in transaction volumes from the combination of rising rates, potentially falling house prices, and also these tax changes, which will hit real estate agents really hard. And I know I can hear the tears flowing from our audience, but you know, transaction volumes are bread and butter for real estate agents. Sadly, they're also bread and butter for state governments because stamp duty relies on transactions. So some state treasuries might have to reevaluate their forecasts.
And the argument about why will in part lead for lower transactions is that because of the taxation changes, is that people who own existing properties that have access to the negative gearing still have that discount, they're not going to want to sell those properties as quickly as they might have otherwise sold them and buy a new house, for example, because you won't get the same tax treatment. So yes, it's going to have a significant impact in lots of different ways, but that broader question about whether or not this is a good or a bad thing, I think that is being debated in the community. And yes, for a very long time, for as long as I've been a journalist, people have been talking about property being unaffordable for first home buyers, that they've been at a disadvantage because of the taxation arrangements that investors were able to take advantage of. And this is something that many economists have suggested for a long time. The difficulty, I think, for the government is, yes, the Treasury modelling says, well, this might lead to house price growth being 2% lower than it would otherwise be. The problem is if it would otherwise be in these current circumstances already going backwards, that's a much harder kind of message to sell, isn't it? They're just going up less than they would otherwise.
And it is a risky time to have bought these in because of rising interest rates and because the fact, look, Sydney and Melbourne were already well on the way to falling home prices before these changes were even flagged. As soon as interest rates reversed course and started going up, Sydney was going to have home price falls. We've seen it before. It was already happening in the auction, clearance rates falling quite dramatically. The sentiment had already turned. In fact, if anything, people talk about the government leaving space for the Reserve Bank. These housing tax changes, if they do take even more steam out of the housing market, we may well be talking about the Reserve Bank not raising rates any further. We're already saying a June rate hike is pretty much off the agenda as far as markets are concerned. Bets on another rate hike in August or September later this year are being lowered. And there's a good chance if this does lead to a housing downturn that we could start talking about rate cuts again by the end of this year, putting a bit of a floor under how far these house price falls go. So swings and roundabouts, that would obviously be good news for the government because existing homeowners with a mortgage really love their mortgage rates falling. And if this contributes to that, that's a pretty positive selling point.
Now, we did have a question from a listener, Mena, about the housing market. They've asked if you could do an analysis of how house floor spaces have increased and graph that against indexed house prices and incomes ratio. Michael?
It's a tricky one. It's especially hard to do graphs on a podcast. But look, in the time we have, the best approximation I can come to is a report the Productivity Commission released early last year where they found that housing construction productivity had fallen by 50% in Australia over the past three decades. But then their wonks did that kind of modelling around housing construction costs and found that even when you adjusted for the fact that houses were bigger and better, housing construction productivity had fallen by 12%. And broadly, you can translate that into saying all other things being equal, housing construction costs were up, would have gone up by about 12% or more for the same quality or size of property. So there's a rising cost for an equivalent build on that side. But then putting my land economics hat on, the single biggest factor behind the surge in Australian housing prices over the past couple of decades is the land price. The land price in the major cities is the significant component of the inflation we've seen. COVID period aside, where we did see, you know, very substantial rise in building costs, more broadly over the past few decades, it's this surge in the price of well-placed land in our capital cities that's been the major factor driving up housing costs. And you can see that because apartment costs have risen nowhere near as much in a city like Sydney as standalone house, because the land price on that standalone house has gone through the roof.
But one of the arguments about why there might be a significantly high floor when it comes to dwelling prices is because it is so expensive to replace them because construction costs have gone up so much. And of course, that the land supply is controlled by the governments and it's very expensive to build infrastructure as well. So it's actually, you know, trying to build new houses is expensive.
It's controlled by the governments, and there's a lot of talk in economics about the planning rules, but people also forget, including the advocates of changing the planning rules and making it easier to develop, but it's also controlled by the private landholders who already exist. So there's no point relaxing the development restrictions in, you know, say, inner West Sydney if the people who currently own large houses in inner West Sydney don't want to sell them. And they're so expensive now, using that example, that there are people who are like, well, actually, even though a developer would come and pay me $4.5 million for my block of land, someone else who wants to keep it as a single block of land would still pay $4 million for it. So
yes, but it would definitely depend on how high you could potentially build on those particular blocks of land. It is part of the argument, right? Is if you actually allowed to full free range in lots of these places, then you would see significant infill, and that would lead, you would think, most economists would agree, to significant reductions in the price of properties there. However, it might also lead to less people wanting to live in those areas.
And it would significantly push up the price of the remaining standalone houses in those areas. And, you know, until we start getting good at building 3- and 4-bedroom apartments that families can live in, there's going to be a substantial market for well-located family homes that currently is mainly being met by standalone dwellings.
We do have a significant piece of data released this week. That's Australia's GDP, or gross domestic product. These will be the numbers for the March quarter. Now, GDP has kind of been the gold standard for trying to measure economic activity within economies. There has been a long-running debate about whether or not it is the right measure, whether or not it does properly account for things that aren't captured in that data, when it comes to things like health outcomes, environmental outcomes, equity. And there was once again an attempt by the UN to come up with a new measure that could at least complement GDP, if not displace it. But it's kind of ended up with yet again a kind of mess of different measures, hasn't it? And yet again, it seems like every time people attempt to do this, it ends in a kind of acrimonious argument about what isn't being captured.
Well, and I think it's because people have confusion about the debate. I mean, there's two problems with GDP. One is that it doesn't measure overall human well-being. And there are already measures around overall human well-being that have existed for quite some time. And what the UN seems to be trying to do is create yet another one of these measures, but even more comprehensive, right? One of the other problems with GDP, which what the UN has done here doesn't seem to address, is that even from a purely economic and fiscal accounting point of view, GDP is not a complete measure, because it doesn't factor in, for instance, externalities. So if you grow your economic output by cutting down a forest, which no longer exists for, you know, to cut down again the next 5 years, you know, and also leads to all these other negative things like erosion, loss of biodiversity, et cetera, loss of potential future tourism.
Removing carbon from the air, which is very relevant to the debate about climate change.
Exactly. So none of these externalities are properly accounted for in GDP. And a classic example is the Christchurch earthquake, which I wrote an analysis piece about when that happened. So you had New Zealand's third biggest city completely in ruins, large parts of it from this earthquake, but ultimately it was a positive for New Zealand's GDP. The economy there had been struggling, and by destroying, you know, a large percentage of the buildings that already existed in Christchurch, you had to rebuild them. And likewise, panel beating services are counted as a positive for GDP because, you know, it's work being done, but it's work being done to repair something that already existed, and GDP doesn't account for the loss of that existing asset. So just from a purely financial point of view, surely there are better ways that we can measure economic growth and capture those negative externalities so that we get a true sense of whether we're better off or whether we're just churning through things and it makes our GDP look good because we're treading water, but really we're treading water to stay where we were rather than getting ahead.
So the UN did create this dashboard of 31 metrics grouped into four buckets representing human rights, sustainability, quality of life, inequality. But even people on the side of believing GDP is inadequate, doesn't capture a lot of things that it does, it seems to end with people saying, well, this doesn't help us. Because on one hand, people want there to be something comparable to GDP. You know, they want a simple number, something that you can measure a proportional percentage change to, so you can compare and say, well, this country is doing better than this one, or it's doing better than it was, etc. This doesn't really help you get there, does it? But what is the significance when it comes to the GDP that is going to be released this week? Is it a helpful number for Australians to understand whether or not our economy is performing well and what that means for well-being within the country?
Look, I think at best it's a useful comparator because it's the same and it's been measured the same way basically since the end of World War II. And, you know, it's a creation of Keynesian economics to have, it's a tool for economic managers to basically judge how well the capacity of the economy is being utilized. So in that sense, it's been a useful measure. If you want to use it as a measure of how well Australians are doing, then it's a less useful measure. For a start, you need to look at GDP per capita, because one of the problems with the headline number is if you just import more people, then of course they will consume more stuff and there will be more people working just because there are more people.
Mm.
But per person, you may well be going backwards.
Yes.
And that's what people live through. So that's just a simple way where you need to get below that headline. And there is information in the national accounts, as they're called, within which GDP is just one of the numbers that you can pull that apart. For instance, you can look at the profit share of national income and compare that to the labour share, the workers' share, versus, you know, the rent share of national income, and kind of weigh up where the money is going. Because again, not much point for the average person if your economy is roaring along, but all the benefit is going to, say, you know, the tech bros who run the biggest AI companies. You know, that's great for them, but not for everyone else.
Yeah, absolutely. But we will be looking through those details later in the week once around. And as you say, they at least give us some indication of how the economy is performing. And it is also a critical number for when it comes to setting government policy and for the Reserve Bank to be looking at how the economy is performing, which could in turn impact interest rates. That is all the time we have for today's episode of ABC Business Daily. We'll be back with another episode tomorrow. Make sure you're following us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to send in a question, just like Mina, we've had a lot of other great ones too, email abcbusinessdaily@abc.net.au. Catch you next time.
See you, Carrington.